Today on Maine Calling, a Your Vote 2022 election analysis. Here we are, the day after Election Day. Lots of us are sleepy after staying up late watching election results. Some are celebrating, some are disappointed, and others are still on pins and needles, waiting for more results. We're still watching pivotal U.S. Senate races, Maine's 2nd Congressional District, and local state Senate races. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on Maine Calling, we begin reading the tea leaves. What did this election mean for the state and for the nation? We have an all-star team to help us break it down. First, our political pulse team of Steve Missler and Kevin Miller. Then, Gene Cummings of the Wall Street Journal, Ron Schmidt from USM, and Mike Shepard of the Bangor Daily News. Maine Calling is just ahead.
Maine Calling On Demand is made possible by Welsh & Forbes, working with clients to manage the full range of events that come with building wealth, from investments to trustee services. More at welshforbes.com. And by Maine Seacoast Mission, strengthening Maine's coastal and island communities through education, health, and support. Learn more at seacoastmission.org.
I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. The votes have been cast, and the results are in. Well, mostly. Today, Maine Public's political pulse team is joining us to talk about the election results, what we know, what we don't know, what it all means. Steve Missler is Maine Public Radio's chief political correspondent, and Kevin Miller, Maine Public Radio's state house correspondent. Welcome back to both of you.
Happy to be here.
Thanks.
Steve, it appears Governor Mills won by at least 10 percentage points, which is what most polls were predicting. A couple of Maine cities were key to her victory, right?
Yeah, that's right, Jen. I mean, there were a couple of keys. So there are traditionally like a couple of keys to winning a statewide election in Maine. And for Democrats, it's basically running up big margins in Portland and communities along the I-295, I-95 corridor, while basically trying to limit landslide losses in the more conservative 2nd Congressional District. And also, you almost have to win the city of Lewiston. Well, Governor Mills did all of that and then some. I mean, she beat LePage in his hometown, his childhood hometown of Lewiston. She beat him in Waterville, where he served as mayor, and she crushed him in Portland and the surrounding communities where all the population density is. I mean, that's the story of the race, I think, in a nutshell. Former Governor LePage tried to make inroads in those areas. He was campaigning there in the final days of the campaign. And he was essentially trying to replicate the victory that Republican Senator Susan Collins had done in 2020, where she definitely made inroads in those areas, specifically the Portland suburbs. But he just couldn't do it, even by softening his image somewhat. So as it stands, Mills leads LePage 56-42 with 80% of precincts reporting. And if that margin holds or grows, it will not only surpass Mills's margin of victory over Republican Sean Moody in 2018, but it will also be one of the most decisive victories in a gubernatorial race since Angus King's absolute rout in 1998.
I don't think anyone's surprised that Shelley Pingree won re-election in the first district, but in the second district, with 80% of the vote counted, Congressman Jared Golden has 49% of the vote. If that holds, the race will go to ranked choice runoff early next week. Kevin, what do we know about the communities whose votes have not yet been counted? Are they likely to go for Golden or Poliquin? And what are the chances this will not be determined by the ranked choice system?
Yeah, Jen. So the presumption all along has certainly been that this race is very likely to end up in a ranked choice runoff. And that really appears to still be the case this morning. But Representative Golden has been creeping ever closer to that kind of magic threshold of essentially 50% plus one vote. Most of the towns that have yet to report are smaller rural towns, but there are a few larger municipalities that I'm still not seeing the results in the various election tally sites. One is Winthrop, which I believe has more than 3,000 voters. Another bigger town that I didn't see at least a little while ago was Bucksport, which had more than 2,000 voters. But I was able to actually find the results on Bucksport's website, and Golden beat Poliquin by about 150 votes. You know, that's a pretty healthy margin, but it doesn't move the overall needle for Golden that much closer to 50% in a race where you have more than 250,000 votes that were cast. So, you know, is it possible? Sure. But is it likely? It's still looking like it's going to head towards a ranked choice election. And then in that situation, we can look back to 2018, where we had the same situation. We had the same three candidates that time. Golden actually came out of Election Day trailing Poliquin. This time around, he's beating Poliquin by more than 12,000 votes. And in 2018, Tiffany Bond's supporters pushed Golden over the top, and that seems to be the likely scenario here as well.
Steve, during the campaigns, we discussed just how much money was pouring into state legislative races, especially two banner races. Let's talk about those. And we'll start with Maine's first Senate district, where Republican Sue Bernard was challenging Senate President Troy Jackson. Talk about what we know at this point, and did all that money have an impact?
Well, Jen, at the moment, Senator Jackson is leading Representative Bernard by 4 percentage points with more than 80% of precincts reporting. He's declared victory, and I haven't seen any Republicans contest that call. To your question about money and its effect on the race, I mean, I suspect it had some effect, which I guess is good news for the people who financed the effort. More than $1 million was spent on that race, which is just astounding for a Senate district in Aroostook County with some 30,000 residents. It's also about a quarter of the money spent by groups working independently of the candidate campaigns this year, which totaled about $4.7 million last check. And most of that money was spent by Democratic-aligned groups, which seem to have learned their lesson from 2010 that legislative races are as important to finance as congressional ones. I'm sure the money and corresponding ads and messaging, you know, sort of annoy voters, but this has been a trend for the past decade. And lately, Democrats in Maine seem to have the advantage in being able to finance these kind of campaigns. But I also really don't want to sell Senator Jackson short here. You know, I mean, he might be one of the only Democrats in this state who can hold that seat. And that's because he's very connected to his constituents there. Money can't buy that. So, you know, yeah, the money may have had an effect on that race, but you can't shortchange Senator Jackson either, because I think he worked really hard there. And again, he's very connected to that district as well.
Kevin, the other high stakes state Senate race was in the Winthrop area, where Senator Craig Hickman faced Republican Jeffrey Hanley. Boy, that race is razor thin.
Yeah, indeed it is. I mean, we've been using the Associated Press for election results, as do most news organizations. And as of right now, AP was showing just about 100 vote margin between Craig Hickman, who's a Democrat, and Republican Jeff Hanley. And that's with about 80% of the votes counted. Both of these gentlemen have represented their areas in the legislature for multiple terms, so they're pretty well known to people out there. But interestingly, the Maine Senate Democratic Campaign Committee sent out a press release a little while ago saying that Hickman had been reelected, and even calling it a, quote, decisive margin. Presumably, they're seeing some local results that AP hasn't factored in yet. But to Steve's point, this is another one of those races where we just saw enormous amounts of spending, not nearly as much as the Senate President Troy Jackson's race, but more than $400,000 of that was spent here in the Senate District 14 race around Winthrop. And the vast majority of that came from Democrats who are trying to help keep Craig Hickman, trying to help Craig Hickman defend his seat.
And both of these are in legislative leadership.
Craig Hickman is not currently in legislative leadership. I know he has run for positions in the past.
Steve, do we know yet what the balance of power will be in the legislature? And were there any surprises?
Well, we know, Jen, that Democrats likely won at least 77 seats in the Maine House, which is enough to retain their majority in the 151 seat chamber. And it looks like they'll probably hold the Senate too. They currently have a 22-13 majority in the Senate, but so far it doesn't look like the GOP netted any additional seats last night. And Jen, I think the surprise here was that the GOP couldn't pick up a majority in either chamber. I mean, a lot of people expected they would at least earn a split control, But that's looking increasingly unlikely to happen. And I think one of the reasons is that Republicans were essentially trying to nationalize a lot of these legislative races, which is a tricky thing to do. But they were specifically trying to chain Democratic legislative candidates to inflation and high gas prices. But the polls we saw all the way up until Election Day and throughout the campaign was that voters weren't making that connection. And honestly, you know, the GOP attempts at blaming Democrats for, you know, say high gas prices were pretty flimsy. Their big attack was blaming Democrats for a carbon tax bill that may have increased gas prices, but that bill went nowhere. It died 3 years ago and never really had a chance. But, you know, whenever Republicans were trying to make this connection between high fuel prices or gas prices and Democrats, that's all they had, because Democrats haven't done anything to that would affect those prices. And so that was really, I think, a problem for the Republicans, and obviously didn't work out for them. You know, and then, of course, I think the places where they do best is where they have quality candidates. And I'm not saying that where they lost, they didn't have quality candidates. I think there's a combination of factors, and Democrats obviously are riding pretty high as a result of those mistakes.
Kevin, for the first time, Maine's legislature will seat two Somali American immigrants. Tell us about them.
Yeah, that's right, Jen. Voters in South Portland elected Deka Dalak to represent them in the Maine House. She currently serves as mayor of South Portland. I believe she came to the U.S. a few decades ago, and she works at a nonprofit program that helps other immigrants and new residents of the state. And then in Lewiston, voters elected Mana Abdi to represent them in the Maine House. She's 26 years old, I believe, and she came to Maine as a refugee with her family when she was a young child. She's a Lewiston High School graduate and also attended the University of Maine Farmington. I think she now works at Bates College. But you know, these are significant victories for Maine's growing immigrant population. Lewiston, of course, has had a pretty robust Somali American community for several decades now, and they've had members of that community serving on local boards for years. But this will give their community a bigger voice at the state level. And of course, you know, there's the gender factor here. We have two, you know, not only the first Somali American legislators, but they're both women to represent them, their communities in the state house.
Steve, Portland voters faced a long ballot. What did we learn from the results of all those questions they faced?
Yeah, I'm not going to tick through all those, Jen, but what I will say is overall, is as bad as last night was for Maine Republicans, it was also pretty rough for progressive activists in the city of Portland and the local chapter of the Democratic Socialists of America. Those activists saw these three big ticket ballot initiatives that they had gotten behind go down in defeat, and pretty convincingly too. The effort to create a strong mayor for the city, which has been debated for years, is currently getting crushed by like 30 percentage points. So is their bid to have an $18 minimum wage in the city. And the same goes for regulations on short-term rentals. Those are all going down. I also think it's helpful to think of these results in the context of what's been going on politically in Portland over the last few years. You have this group of progressive activists essentially trying to reshape city government in the state's most liberal city. But what you saw during the campaign is that local Democrats, even I guess you might call them, I don't know, mainstream Democrats, rebelled against these initiatives. So even in the liberal bastion of Portland, there was a rejection of this years-long effort to make the city more liberal. And look, I mean, I think it's absolutely fair to point out that the progressive groups were outspent on a lot of these ballot initiatives. But just like any other contest across the state, I don't think money tells the whole story of the results we're seeing right now.
Kevin, are there other ballot initiatives around the state you are paying close attention to?
Yeah, well, several towns had big school funding initiatives that received a lot of local attention because of their potential impact on property taxes. Voters in Cape Elizabeth pretty resoundingly rejected a proposed $116 million bond for what I believe would have been a new elementary school and middle school and renovations to the high school. A little further up I-295, voters in Cumberland and North Yarmouth, they rejected a $74 million school bond proposal. And again, a lot of the concern here focused on what those those much needed improvements to what are overcrowded or aging schools could do to local property taxes. Elsewhere around Maine, Bar Harbor residents voted to only allow up to 1,000 cruise ship passengers to disembark and to make their town and to make their way into town every day. You know, this comes after years of frustration from local residents and even some businesses about these mega cruise ships who dump huge numbers of passengers onto downtown Bar Harbor's already crowded streets in the summertime. There is some speculation that the cruise ship industry actually will challenge the referendum in court. So we'll have to see what happens there.
Steve, it strikes me. Oh, I'm sorry, Kevin. Go ahead.
Oh, finish. Sorry. And the last one I'd add was another interesting one was in Booth Bay Harbor and Booth Bay and Southport. Voters, they voted to keep adding fluoride to the local public drinking water system. And this is kind of part of a national debate that we've seen over the past couple of years.
One thing that strikes me listening to what you all are saying about statewide races, as well as what's happening in Portland, what happened in these school districts, Steve, is that it seems as though moderates took the day.
Yeah, I think that's a fair assessment, Jen, you know, and not really a surprise, right? Because if you think about the state, I mean, Maine generally, you know, I guess you could argue right now that it's definitely leaning left, but and certainly Democrats have an edge in registered voters here, but they're not so far left that, you know, that they're going to basically alienate the other side of the aisle on a lot of issues. I mean, I think they were framed as doing that by the Republicans, especially in state races, legislative races and whatnot, but that's just not the case. And I think voters get that. And I think that's especially true with Governor Janet Mills. I mean, one thing I didn't mention, I mean, you were asking about how she performed last night. One of the things that she did was she was able to win some towns that are in conservative strongholds, not by a lot. You know, I'm thinking of like Hamden, for example, where she sort of eked out a victory there against LePage. Hamden is a pretty conservative place. And I don't think you win in a place like that if you're super left, right? And I think Governor Mills, I think that's one of the reasons why she's done well in rural parts of the state. Now, you know, I'm not saying that she's running away with it in those places, but she's, you know, she can hold her own. And I think that really matters in this state because after all, you know, Portland and the surrounding communities are just a portion of it. And I think if Democrats can continue to do that, they're in pretty good position here. And it's a real contrast to nationwide where Democrats are getting a lot of heat for being out of touch with rural parts of the country. And in Maine, they seem to be beating back that reputation.
Well, Kevin Miller, Steve Missler, thank you so much for joining us today, the Political Pulse team on Maine Calling. When we come back, the Wall Street Journal's Gene Cummings and USM political science professor Ron Schmidt join us for the rest of the hour. And we'll hear from Mike Shepard from the Bangor Daily News. This is Maine Calling. Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the show, election analysis. My guests, USM political science professor Ron Schmidt and Gene Cummings, deputy Washington bureau chief for the Wall Street Journal. We want to hear your thoughts on yesterday's election. You can share your comments and questions via email, talk@mainepublic.org. Comment on Facebook or Twitter or Instagram, or of course, give us a call, 1-800-399-3566. Welcome back to both of you, and thank you for taking the time. I know it was a late night for both of you. Gene, I'll start with you. Nationally, there is still a lot we do not know, races still to be decided. But overall, this was not the Democratic drubbing many had predicted. Why?
Well, we're still digging around in numbers to try to figure out what exactly motivated voters this cycle. But it definitely was not the so-called shellacking that Obama got and that Biden was fearful of and many expected to happen because midterm elections just go against the party in power. The last five presidents have lost majorities in Congress in these midterms, and the Republicans are expected to take the majority in the House. The Senate's still up for grabs. But we had polling done and research done by AP's VoteCast, and the indications in those numbers, which is a very large national poll. It's not a traditional poll, but it's interviews with voters over the course of about a week, about 90,000 voters. So it's very large, suggests that independence in the end, surprisingly, broke for the Democrats. And in many cases, that was because they viewed some of the GOP candidates as more extreme than they were comfortable with.
Mm. Ron, did the results surprise you?
Surprise is a strong word, but I thought this is one possibility, but it wasn't the one I thought was the most likely. No, I mean, I wasn't sure we were going to actually see a so-called red wave. But this is really more of a red splash, it seems. Of course, when congressional majorities are on a razor's edge, that still matters a lot. We'll see how it all plays out. But the night was less disruptive than I figured it would be.
Gene, as you alluded to, the conventional wisdom is that midterms are really about two things, the popularity of the current president and the economy. And I'm wondering if a lot of pundits underestimated the power of reproductive rights and the women's vote.
I definitely think abortion played a role in some of the races. And I also think what we should pay more attention to is the quality of the candidates. You know, the House is going to break the way we would expect in a midterm, but not in as we've noted, not in a sweeping way. But some of the candidates for Senate in particular were so distinct in their personalities and in their campaign style and their messaging that it really broke through to voters. And what we saw, for instance, in Georgia is yet to be decided, and likely a runoff, but there is a possibility that Warnock can find the math to a win. It's a very tight path, but that is undoubtedly why AP is waiting. But what we saw in the suburbs was the Republican governor outperforming Senate candidate Herschel Walker. And so what we could see was split voting. And that does not happen very often, where voters in the suburbs voted for Republican Kemp for governor and then Democratic Warnock for the Senate. And that there was some of that in Pennsylvania, too. This is really unusual where we see a year where voters are very much paying attention to who they're voting for and not just which party's jersey they tend to wear all the time.
Ron, Maine's Secretary of State Shenna Bellows estimated voter turnout here in Maine at 70%. What does that say to you?
To me, it's great news. I felt good already just going to vote yesterday and not being able to find a parking space. There's been a lot of talk in the last few years, appropriately, about the risks that democracy has been in. And the best way to defend democracy is to participate in democratic activity. And Maine always has high turnout, but yesterday's was truly noteworthy and suggested a lot of engagement, not just among one party or the other, but across groups, including, I believe, independents.
On the line with us now, Michael Shepherd, political editor for the Bangor Daily News. Mike, thanks for giving us a call. I know that you've closely been following the second congressional district race. Last I checked the results, Jared Golden was at 49%. Is that still the case? And what do you think is going to happen next?
Yeah, I mean, this is going to go to a ranked choice count kind of in name only. We've got him right around 48.5% of votes right now with 85% reporting. So he's about, he's closing in on a 4-point lead on Bruce Poliquin. He's going to win this race. We've done some polling that showed he's got a clear majority of the supporters of Tiffany Bond, who ranked a second choice. So he's going to be pushed above that 50% threshold very easily, and his margin of victory should expand once that's all done. But it's not going to be formalized until next week. We've got to go through the process, but I'm pretty confident telling you right now that this race is over for all. intents and purposes.
So a Democratic sweep with governor and both congressional districts. Is Maine no longer purple but blue?
I don't know. I think this election turned out to be a very strange one, right? You have the power of incumbency, and I think it can't be lost on people. I mean, Republicans made a pretty bold choice in this election. They picked two people to run for higher office who are pretty unpopular, frankly. Paula Page, she got 48% of votes or so, a little over that in 2014. That was his high watermark. He never did better than that in approval polls. He never did better than that at the polls. And so I think we knew that about Paula Page coming in, that he has a base that loves him. And that love is very strong, and it may be much stronger than the love that Janet Mills has from her base. But bases don't win elections if the other person is just more popular. And I think we certainly saw that with Bruce Colquitt as well. I mean, much of his campaign was built on going around the state, kind of trying to ride LePage's coattails, thinking that he was a more popular bet in the second district. And none of this worked, frankly. And I think Republicans have a lot of soul searching to do. I still think they can win elections in this state. Susan Collins did it in 2020. But they got to pick candidates who have that kind of appeal. And they just didn't do it, and they failed in Tuesday's election.
And Mike, the Maine legislature looks like both houses also going Democrat. Anything in the Maine legislative races that surprised you?
Yeah, there were some really interesting races here. I think what surprised me is that Republicans basically made up no ground whatsoever in the Senate. They might actually lose the seat, and they were already going into this election trailing 22-13 in that chamber and had some high hopes. There were a couple races that they were counting on that didn't go their way, including an open seat down in the Windham area that was won by a Democrat over a former Republican state senator. In the House, it looks like Democrats will have an 82-seat majority, basically a stalemate from the 2020 election. So yeah, I was surprised that Republicans basically made just no progress on that front. And there were a couple, there are a few races on either side, particularly in the House, that swung one way or the other. But yeah, it's just a really bad result for Republicans who were really thinking they could win the House on Tuesday night. But again, just didn't really come anywhere close.
Mike Shepard, political editor for the Bangor Daily News. Thanks so much for calling in today. Gene, I'll turn to you. Where do Maine's results fit in with the national picture?
Well, it's really interesting what's happening up in your state. I think Maine remains purple because of, especially with Senator Sue Collins. And, she faced a very tough race before and came through. And it goes to what Mike was talking about. She really has her own independent connection with voters. And that is so important for any incumbent. And we see that in Alaska with Murkowski. And, she weathered Trump's anger and that sort of thing. And yet, she's looking pretty good. They also have the ranked voting there too. So it's going to be a bit before we know for sure what happens up there, but she's looking in pretty good shape. And I think that you just can't emphasize enough, as much as we like to rely on, get a lot of money and get a lot of ads on TV and let's see what the polls say. What it comes down to often is that personal connection with the voters. And I think Maine is the sort of state where that is a really important part of success or failure in your political world.
Ron, earlier I asked Jean what she felt as though the impact of reproductive freedom and the women's vote was on this race. Didn't get to ask you the same question. How much of a factor was it in your view?
Well, listening to former Governor LePage's non-concession speech last night, I was struck by the way he framed that issue. He said, that he thought Mainers were going to care about heating oil and instead they cared about abortion. And I think for a lot of people in Maine, particularly, but not only women, the idea that you've got to make a choice between heating oil and bodily autonomy is just not a framing that they're going to accept. That they feel that as citizens, they have a right to expect to both be in charge of their own medical care and to be able to have sufficient funds to make it comfortably through the winter. I think that that approach to it is also something that we see in some younger voters. I think to the degree to which the politicians still try to frame abortion as a quote unquote culture issue is a serious misreading of the way a lot of Americans approach it.
And speaking of young people, Rod, and I'm going to ask you about this too, Gene, something really struck me yesterday. Secretary of State Shenna Bellows was in our program, and she said that the youth vote last time, that the oldest people in Maine and the youngest people, the youngest voters in Maine, were the two biggest turnout groups. You know, there's this thinking that young people don't vote, but at least here in Maine, young people vote more than middle-aged people vote. And you teach them. I'm sure you're not surprised.
No, I'm not. But it is. It's good news. You know, one of the things I teach them that it is that it's a cliche in political science that they, particularly college students, do not vote. And it seems to come as a pretty big surprise to them. I think, you know, Maine at least has a tradition of a sort of pragmatic approach to politics as a way to deal with basic issues. I suppose it's not a real surprise that our young people take that attitude as well.
And Gene, what do we know about the vote of the youngest demographic nationally? Are young people turning out in greater numbers than they have in previous elections?
They are very much engaged. There's no doubt about it. And I think it goes to, you know, things like the abortion issue, where it's shocking to them. They have, you know, have lived in a world where the right to make decisions about their own body has been there for all their lives. And suddenly it's in question. And that's a wake up call. And it's not a good one for them. It was interesting. CNN's exit poll for House races last night found that, and this is something that I think Republicans need to recognize, at least, is that the vote for 18 to 29 year olds was all Democratic by plus 28. Huge. Wow. Just a huge number. It's a generation that is being lost to the Republicans. And I think a lot of it is the cultural issues and the fights against their, you know, abortion and criticism of the, you know, the gay community and the getting rid of books in Florida. I mean, all that stuff is not sitting well with the next generation. And, you know, I think that that's something that the Republicans need to kind of recognize, that this generation that's coming up behind us all is very tilted in the Democratic sphere.
We'll go to Robert calling from Parsonsfield. Hi, Robert. Go ahead.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I've been trying to get an answer on this for a while. It's kind of down in the weeds, but redistricting was huge all over the country, and I wondered how Maine redistricted after the census, and if your experts think that that had an effect on any of the races. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for the question, Robert. And Ron, I know that when redistricting happened, you and others thought it wouldn't have much of an impact because of the way Maine does it. Did that turn out to be the case?
I don't know yet. And I am a little bit curious as to whether or not moving Augusta from one district to another is going to turn out to have played a part in what we saw last night. But I'm still not prepared to say that I'm sure that's the case. I think we're sort of a special case nationally in the way that we handle that question.
And for those who don't know, how are we different?
Well, I mean, I would say that it's because there aren't that many Mainers, and that our redistricting is at least as much geographical as it is partisan or demographic. But there are other states that have small populations that are intensely partisan. So I think it might have something to do with the approach that our state legislators find rewarding in terms of votes, that Mainers can get very partisan, but seem to recoil at a certain level of partisan activity.
Robert, thanks so much for your call. We do need to take another quick break. If you want to join the conversation about election results, give us a call, 1-800-399-3566. You can find us on social media or send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org. We'll be right back. Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You are listening to Maine Calling. Our guest today, Gene Cummings, Deputy Washington Bureau Chief for the Wall Street Journal, and University of Southern Maine Political Science Professor Ron Schmidt. Join our conversation, 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page or to Instagram. We'll go to Larry, who's calling from Bangor. Hi, Larry. Go ahead.
Hi. The media has a hard time calling spade a spade. I don't. LePage is a consummate liar. My question is this. To reuse a phrase, that is, will the nattering nabob of negativism go back to Florida and hide for a while and then come back, try to pretend he's a nice guy, or is he finally gone? And obviously, I hope he's finally gone.
Larry, thanks. Ron, can former Governor LePage run again if he wants to?
I'd say it's more a question of whether the party would want him to. He could try, but the former governor's winning strategy was never really a majoritarian one. It was always one about sort of mobilizing his base, which was always a plurality of the population. And if we continue to see the kind of things we did yesterday, where the entire electorate is incredibly mobilized, that strategy is at a disadvantage. You know, it's funny that Larry brought up the Spiro Agnew quote, because I was thinking last night of Richard Nixon's, you're not going to have Richard Nixon to kick around anymore, speech from the early 60s when LePage gave his remarks. And Nixon came back. We'll see.
Larry, thanks for your call. We'll go to Malia calling from Vermont. Hi, Malia. Go ahead.
Hi. Thanks so much for taking my call. I just wanted to say I just graduated from Bates in May, and I did a lot of the election work there. And I'm watching all the students at all of the colleges in Maine work really, really hard this election to make it possible to see those large young voter turnout numbers happen. And so I just wanted to give them credit, because it's not easy work, especially on a college campus. So just very proud of everything that students across Maine were doing to get out those young voters yesterday.
Malia, I want to ask you, when you talk about doing the election programming at Bates, what did you do exactly? What were some of the activities?
Yeah, I mean, I was working in 2020 during the pandemic, so it was a little bit different. But we did a lot of voter registration programming, setting up tables at the library and doing as much tabling as we could. And then also trying to host events for students to talk about kind of the overwhelming, ambiguous feelings during the pandemic, but also in general. I think, you know, young people are looking at elections as pretty indicative of what our future might look like. So we were trying to create spaces for students to be able to kind of air their complicated feelings and also enfranchise them.
Malia, thank you so much for calling in. Jean, when you hear from her, how does this generation compare to generations past?
Actually, young people have been engaged in politics for, a couple of decades. And so I don't know that this generation is exceptional in that regard. I think that they are, but I do think when the political environment starts moving into cultural issues, and we're talking about a generation that lived through or lived with the idea of school shootings, for instance. This is a generation that has lived through a pandemic. This is a generation that has lived through two financial crises. I mean, this young generation has been kind of unable to just go live their soccer practices and you know, kind of go to the prom and live in their own little world. The real world has had real impact on these young voters. And so I think that is something that does motivate them in a different way than we've seen in prior generations.
Really interesting. And Ron, as Gene was talking, I was thinking to myself, how much more sophisticated the young people I know who are in my life were when I was that age.
Yes. No, I've noticed the same thing. They show up in my intro classes already knowing a lot about both how the system is supposed to work and how they can make it work better for them.
Thanks, Malia, for your call. We'll go to Nick, who's calling from Hollowell. Hi, Nick. Go ahead.
Well, hi. Thanks for taking my call. And just briefly, I moved to Maine in 1974 from the Midwest, and this is home, and I'm just so proud to be from Maine, especially about the politics. It's balanced. People are, for the most part, very reasonable. And I'm just really proud that my son-in-law, who lives in Brunswick, just got elected yesterday to the State House. And it's and I just want to say one last thing. The young people, you know, I'm 77, going to be 78, and I'm on my way out, but it's really heartening to see young people energetic and voting and participating. So that's what I want to say.
Nick, thanks so much for your call. One thing I was struck by at the polls yesterday in my town, Ron, there were high school students giving out donuts if you would stop and text two more people to vote. That was a first.
I wish that the high school students in Freeport could take that lesson. Some donuts yesterday would have been great.
We have an email here from Anne. My question is, who benefits financially from all the money spent during the campaigns? Is it media companies, TV stations, newspapers? Gene?
It is not newspapers. It is definitely TV stations.
Yeah, that's it.
And, you know, polling, you know, there are all kinds of advisors. There's more online action now. But, you know, the bulk of the money goes to the TV ads. But what I have found interesting in the last couple of cycles, and it definitely, I could feel it last night, is that everybody can raise money, right? We used to see races where, well, I guess the Pennsylvania governor's race is an exception. But for the most part, candidates can get enough money to run a decent campaign. And so then they all go and they put their TV ads on. So there's no shortage of TV ads. And you can get flooded with polls, which we know some are junk, some are good, but who could tell the difference? So what it's really coming down to is turnout. Do you get your voters to the polls? Everybody's going to have enough money. Everybody's going to have enough TV ads. And everybody's going to be able to read any poll they want to satisfy themselves. But in the end, we're getting really back to the basics now. Get your people to the polls.
An email here from Kia. We in Portland learned 2 years ago the challenging effects of referendums becoming laws without the vetting by experts and input from stakeholders. I think this time around, Portlanders looked much more carefully at these referendums, not just to quick talking points. I hope that the ultimate result is that the law by defending does not continue to happen here. And I think what she means is the law by referendum does not continue to happen here. And Ron, we saw that Portland had a long list of ballot questions and many of them failed, which was a bit of a surprise to some people.
Yeah, I'm interested in seeing what the learning curve winds up being here. You know, I'm originally from California, where initiatives have long been a huge part of Election Day in terms of the amount of paper they take up on top of everything else. In California, a problem has become that if there's an initiative you don't like and you have money, you can flood the ballot with initiatives that look similar but are actually very different and do less. And the impact seems to be that at a certain point, voters just get fatigued and sort of turn off to the entire process. So the question is, you know, how do you relate to these issues in a way that's more productive? Can elected officials or regulators see the reoccurrence of these issues as something they need to deal with? Can the people who are putting the initiatives on the ballot try to respond in a way that's more flexible? I have a feeling we're going to get some other chances to see.
An email here from Dewey. I think that a reason the Republicans are losing strength is that they are just so negative. I see their emails and they're always attacking people, appealing to voters' darker angels, which actually is not appealing at all. Plus, their only platform is cutting taxes. They are a one-trick pony. To rebound, they will need to find candidates who address problems and can be bipartisan and can smile. Looking happy is much more appealing than looking angry. Jean.
Well, I think both sides can get pretty hysterical in these races. I mean, if you look at the Georgia Senate race, I mean, both those candidates ended up in a bloody heap. It's just the ads were very, very negative. I do, though, think that the idea of a different kind of platform would be an interesting thing to see, because I don't think I mean when the only thing that the Republican majorities have really passed in recent years in Congress, at least, not speaking for state legislatures, she's correct, tax cuts. There's not a healthcare bill. There's not an immigration bill. There's not a climate bill. They don't have a wide range of other initiatives. And maybe that would be appealing to voters. I don't know, because it hasn't been tested.
What do you think of that, Ron?
I completely agree. The GOP has decided not really to run on policy so much as on the politics around campaigning. And that has some weaknesses that they're beginning to encounter. I also, not to sound too cynical, but relentlessly negative advertising can turn off voters, especially independent voters. And so if you feel really super confident that your base is fired up and that they're going to show up, turning off other voters might work to your advantage. We need, I think, to find ways to incentivize a way of running that is more geared towards solutions.
Ron, we know that a lot of people moved to Maine during the pandemic. Different lists have different numbers exactly, but in the top 10, how did that impact this election? The person I was behind at the poll was registering to vote and had just moved here.
I honestly don't know yet. I still got to wait for the dust to clear before I can figure that out. That is one of the key questions to pay attention to, but I don't have an answer yet.
Jean, I want to go back to something you said earlier, and I don't even have a fully formed question here, but you were talking about how this is getting back to basics. You can spend so much on ads, you can watch polls. And it makes me think we have this huge conversation, especially since Citizens United, about money and politics. Are many of us, I guess the question is, directing our frustration or our focus in the wrong place?
Well, I mean, the strange thing, you know, I've covered money and politics for decades. And, you know, going back to the 90s, when it really mattered, you know, if you could, you know, get bundlers and get the big donors and get the labor unions in. And, you know, we'd write about this all the time. But, you know, more than 10 years ago, the Democrats kind of unlocked that box with small donors. And so it's just not an issue anymore. They just get tons of donors who give a little. And Republicans still have a more traditional fundraising model. However, they're trying to change, and they are in the process of change. And Trump, you know, clearly had a very large small donor base that could fuel him forever. So, you know, some of these things that had at one time created obstacles for candidates are just no longer that relevant. But the one thing that remains the ultimate relevance is the voters. You need to get your people to cast their vote. And that is the very fundamental part of our democracy. And it is now the most important thing in any of these races.
I so appreciate both of you taking the time to be with us today on Maine Calling. The voice you just heard, Gene Cummings, Deputy Washington Bureau Chief for the Wall Street Journal. Also with us, Ron Schmidt, Professor of Political Science at the University of Southern Maine. Today's sound engineer was KG Akimoladun. Maine Calling is produced by Cindy Hahn and Jonathan Smith. Visit mainecalling.org to subscribe to our weekly newsletter and to find the archive of our past shows. Tomorrow on the program, a reprieve from politics is our annual Made in Maine gift guide. If you want to recommend a craftsperson or local store, email talk@mainepublic.org and please include a web link and a photo if possible. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.